No. So to learn how to do prime factorization better than classical algorithms, turns out you need to know a little bit how to factorize prime numbers, classical algorithms. So it's a bit challenging. I think in the end we converge to something that is doable, but it may take 1.5 tutorials. But I think it's worth it to get to see sort algorithm. At least anyway, there are some things that you're gonna have to take as faith related to the math, unless you already know number theory. But I think it's gonna be a cool one. Just be prepared for a long 1.5 tutorial kind of thing. So may continue on the last one too. All right. See, because Grover's algorithm only source algorithm only replaced one step of the algorithm to factor prime numbers. There's an algorithm to factor prime numbers, right? And there's one part that is actually difficult. You've done it many times, like people have done in high school, when they give you a number and start telling you, okay, use the tricks that you know in order to find the optimal possible, the list of numbers that would give you a prime number when you multiply. There's one step that the complexity is sub-exponential in the sense of exponential of d to the one third, right? That step is the one that's replaced by a quantum algorithm that is d to the 3 instead. It's much better than sub-exponential, of course. But of course, that's a little part of the algorithm. So it takes a little bit of introduction. By the way, who knows? Does anybody know here what's the largest number that we factor using Shor algorithm?
2n minus 1.
Okay, yeah. But what is it? What's n? So for a long time, it was 15. 15 is the first one that's non-trivial, by the way. You'll see why. That's explained there. 15 is the first one you can claim, oh, it's a non-trivial factorization. 21. There was a claim that they factor a very long number. And then Scott Aronson did a really great analysis of why that's not the case. They haven't done that. So yeah, 21 is the largest purely, properly sure factorizing an experiment number. It will still be, even though it's true that the scaling is so much better, it will still be decades at the very least. We are safe with RSA as we are, huh? But there will still be decades until quantum computers break our private public key cryptography. Yep.
I'm just curious what was the overhead of qubits?
I don't remember, but you can imagine quite a lot, yeah. Well, I mean, you can reduce the overhead if you implement in trapped ions. Trapped ions, you have a lot of control, but of course, that scales poorly, right? Trapped ions really don't scale that great. The things that seem to scale better need a lot of physical qubits, yeah. There are even controversy, right, about is that really, are you doing the right thing when you have something huge like that? I don't know. It will still be a while. It's not that tomorrow or in 5 years, somebody is going to tell you, oh, I have a quantum computer here that everybody's out of work in the classical cryptography industry. It will take longer than that. All right, okay, 21 is not bad. I mean, you'll see. All right, let's talk about Grover's algorithm. Grover's algorithm is less powerful in terms of what it does as compared to a classical algorithm. It's prettier, I would say, in terms of, because you can actually talk about it geometrically very nicely. Again, the whole reason we are looking at this is, remember that we saw circuits, right? Logic circuits, which is the way we implement things in classical computers. We basically want a logic. We want to be able to do all operations, and we decompose the ability to store information and process information, talking about bistable systems that can have state 0, state 1, right? We saw that we can build circuits, for example, to sum and other, right? That can do carry in, carry out sum, full sum. One question that stands to reason is like, okay, what happens if I actually do a quantum circuit, the quantum equivalent to that? What happens if instead of a number, I have a superposition of two numbers and put it through the circuit? What do I get in the end? Do I get the superposition of the result? How does that even work? You will do a ton more, by the way. But the point is like, well, it stands to reason that perhaps if we substitute the classical circuits by quantum ones, maybe we can do things better. Because we have a larger space. We can have superpositions to begin with. We can play with entanglement too. We can have non-trivial measurements. We can have things that seems to us that maybe we can get advantages over classical stuff. Turns out it's tough to get advantage over classical stuff, because in the end, many quantum things can be efficiently simulated by classical computers. As we know, we do quantum mechanics in computers all the time. But we know there's things that can't, right? And we should be able to find new things. There's very few that we found that are really a true advantage in terms of doing something practical. Grover's algorithm is one of those. Grover's algorithm is about what is called unstructured search. What is that? Well, I have, so you might have a list of things that I put in registers, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, I could do it, and so on. And then I have some register U1W that I am interested in, right? And then you have, if you start at 0, you get M minus 1 register. You're interested in finding W. So I don't know, for example, think that this is a list of names, right? And I give you a phone number, and you want to associate a phone number with a name. That makes sense? So this one here, the one associated with phone number W, will have some information here, which is maybe the name of the person, right? And that's what we want to find. Now, classically, there are many search algorithms, right? The optimal algorithms all scale the same, and scale in a very intuitive way. You need to, it's going to scale polynomially, linearly on the number of entries, right? Because it makes sense, right? Imagine, one, I go one by one. What's the probability that this one is the one you're looking for? 1/n. What's the probability? 1/n. So in general, you need to check of the order of n times to guarantee that you find it with a probability that is high enough to call it, I'm sure I'll find it. Does that make sense? All the algorithms suffer the same kind of logic. In fact, optimal algorithms and looking at random are the same. It depends how you program them, but they're basically, from the computer science perspective, just randomly checking one by one is optimal. Classically. Does that make sense? All right. Now, what about quantumly? What about if I have a quantum algorithm? How about I get to implement my registers in a quantum register, right? In terms of I have this information stored in bits, I have it in terms of qubits. Like, for example, imagine I have 8 elements. So I have 8 elements, and I associate the register, right? Those elements, if you want, with 3 qubits. Well, I can do it like this. This is common notation. Quantum info. Okay. Those are 8 registers. If you write it in terms of in binary, right, talking about qubits, that is 000, 001, 010, 011, 100. 101, 110, and 111. All right. So the idea is, okay, I have a list of things. This represents, for example, I have a list of things, and this Hilbert space represents the spaces of possible phone numbers, right? And I have associated each of these states with one register. So among all the possible registers, I want to find the target one. I know one of them. I want to know which one it is. That makes sense? All right, so we're going to build something called an oracle. What is an oracle? Well, the oracle for us is going to be something that, first of all, is called oracle because it distinguishes among the ones that you want to. This oracle is going to be a non-local unitary that acts on all the qubits. And this oracle is going to flag out the thing that you're looking for. It's going to put a distinctive mark in whatever you're looking for. That's what we call an oracle. So let me give you an oracle. So I wanted, for example, in this case, in global algorithm, it's going to flip the sign of the state with the winning property. What's the winning property? So say that I want to find this W register. So there's going to be a state. I'm going to call KW. That's the state with the winning property, the one that matches whatever you're looking for. Okay? So you have to make up an operator and a unitary operation that flips the sign, if applied, to the winning state and leaves the other ones unchanged. Now you see now, one of the differences between classical and quantum shows up here, which is if I will classically, you just flag one of them. You have to go one by one and so on. Whereas here, I can implement an unlocal operation that can act on a superposition of states and will flag out one component of that superposition. Does that make sense? That's basically what the algorithm relies on. That makes sense. I have a winner. I want to find it. So for every winner, I have an oracle. It's like a classical oracle could be just writing, typing the number on a text box. That's your oracle. Does that make sense? I'm doing an operation based on what you type. All right, so if it's going to be by flipping the sign, then I know what this is going to be. Let me call it UW, and this unitary acting on a vector x is going to give me minus 1 f to the x and the state, and state of the basis, and f of x is going to be a function that is going to be a 0 if x is equal to w and 1. Minus 1, one, because I got it like that. X is, my bad, 0 if it's different from W, and 1 if it's exactly equal to W. This is how it acts on a basis, right? So this X is the computational basis in which you encode. That makes sense? So yeah, this thing flips the sign. So if I, in other words, if I apply UW to X, this gives me X. For x different from w and minus x for x equals w, right? That's what it does. So if you want to represent it as a matrix, so imagine in our example, of 8 elements, right? If we want to find that our winner is 101, right? Say that that's the one we're interested in, then the UW would be 101 is the third last. So you get 5 minus 1, 5, 6. Yeah, go ahead.
I guess I'm a little confused just because it feels like if we know W equals 101, then we've already solved the problem.
No. You're trying to find what is contained. This is the label. What is quantum is your label. For example, what could be quantum is the superposition of is phone numbers. You encode phone numbers, and that's not what you're interested in finding. You're interested in finding the name. But you're going to prepare a state that for each number, you tensor with a name. So you want to find the number among the many that points to a particular name. So you know the winning property. Tell me all the information contained in the register with a W. Does that make sense? It's the same in a classical search.
Great, but I just mean if we knew the information we wanted was associated with the label 101.
Find the label. That's the problem. Among a list that is not ordered, find your label.
But that's my question is how do we build this oracle if we don't know which...
In practice. Imagine that you have a property that is could be spin of a particle, and you use spin to encode the numbers. And it's very easy. Your oracle is going to be a U pointing in a particular direction that flips one of the spin, for example.
Yeah, I also am confused about this because, I don't know, you're looking for something that is inside this...
The box, yeah.
I don't know, like, without seeing what is inside each of them, like how...
Think classically. So this problem that you have in can be used for the classical version too. Imagine that I have classical labels, right? And something is containing the labels. For example, labels are phone numbers. The classical the containers contain names, right? And I tell you, okay, I want to find this number among the list. I say, okay, but if you know the number, you know which box. Yeah, sure, but find it in a book. See what I mean? It's literally the same problem.
I see. So we're looking for W, but we just don't know where W is.
Correct. That's why it's a search.
We know what W is.
We know what W is. You know a phone number, you want to know a name associated with it that's contained in a box that is labeled with that, but among all the possible ones, it's not easy for you to know which one is labeled like that.
Okay, that makes sense.
That makes sense? Yeah.
Like your representation of the states, like you know that we have all of this, but we don't know which order they are.
Correct. Yeah.
Now it makes more sense to me.
I wrote it like that just to have a good representation, right? But of course, it's a tech, they're not ordered. The point is that they're not like physically ordered by these labels.
Yeah.
All right?
I exactly.
Okay, fair. That makes sense then? That's important, right? If we lose track of the motivation, if it feels like a trivial problem, it's less impressive when you solve it in a fast way. Make sense? Any more questions about that? All right, so we're clear on the operation that we call the oracle. So the oracle will distinguish one state or one component, if you want, in a given basis of a state containing the information. Now, the key point here is how you prepare your register. In the classical case, your register in a phone book, right, is a density operator that is diagonal in the computational basis. Agreed? It's 1 over n projector over all the possible numbers summed. So a classical probability distribution over every number with equal probability. Agreed? If you look at random book, you're going to get with probability 1 over n the right answer. The point here is, okay, instead of encoding it like that, which is the old way of encoding it, encode it using a quantum superposition, a pure state. Make sense? So my list is going to be encoded. We have the oracle here. And I'm going to say like, and structure. You see, that's the word and structure coming in. You don't know how it's structured. The data is not structured. And structure. List. I'm going to have a state S that is going to be 1 over root n sum small n equals 0, or x maybe because I call it x. Of course, x equals 0, right, to n minus 1 of state x. All right, so it's an equal superposition of all possible registers, right? Make sense? You have the same amount of information, which is the minimum possible, about what the outcome of checking one at random will be. This is the quantum version of the classical distribution. That makes sense, everybody? Of course, this thing, because typically in quantum computing, people like to draw lines, as we talked about it, like, how can you even draw lines, you know, which is true, if you have entanglement and things like that. People like to draw lines. The convention is typically that you start at zero on the left, always. So having the state that you want requires a part of a quantum circuit that is the preparation part. That's why I'm going to write like that. This is just an equal superposition, so it's a tensor of Hadamards on all the possible qubits that you have. So this thing would be, just to write it properly, is h to the power n, capital N, right? Yeah, on the zero for all the registers. Make sense, everybody?
Can you repeat this? What's the notation?
What's up?
It would be little n because we're encoding them in binary.
Oh, yeah. My bad. Little n where? Thank you. Yeah, that's about the dimension. Number of qubits. Thank you. That makes sense, everybody? So for our example, it would be 3. All right. So again, if you have that state representing your list, the chances, if you measure, let's try to measure x in that state. If we measure, the probability of finding x equals w, right, is of course wx, which is 1 over n. Same as you had, yep.
I didn't understand something.
Go ahead.
At the beginning, we have all x's, but we want to just mix them, right? But you set it from zero.
Like, sorry, what?
My algorithm, as an input, takes some x's, like those numbers, and those.
No. Okay, your algorithm takes a list as an input. Takes a winner as an input. You want a number, and it returns a register in an structured list. Okay, your algorithm is going to tell you where W is in this list. That makes sense? It's the same as classical algorithm, right? I want to know where a number is in a phone book.
No, I'm talking about the S part.
Yeah.
On 0, 0, 0.
Oh, this is forget about it. The algorithm does not require that. The algorithm uses this. Now, this is just a representation in terms of, this is to write a circuit, right? People love this. So if you have, you can do the following. I can prepare the state. I can write my circuit and say, this is S. I begin with S, and I draw from there. Or rather, what you can do is, well, maybe I'll draw it like that, right? And then means like, there's nothing on the left. I start with S, the beginning of my circuit.
Start from S, we start from X, right? We have a bunch of X. We want to move.
No, you have to prepare that, your list. Okay. In classical, in the classical case, you have the ideal of the list with the information, but you have to put it in a book. So you have to print the book, build the book, build the pages, etc. Right? Here, my list, instead of encoding, the book is the support where I encode the information. I'm gonna encode my information now in a superposition, in a quantum superposition. That's what I'm doing. And this is a quantum superposition that has equal probability of finding any of the entries, same as a book.
Yeah, but we have letters, for example. We want to do operation and make book, right?
So yeah.
Starting point is letters and numbers, and then making book.
Right.
I don't see this transition from numbers to book, because you also make somehow...
You have numbers, and you have a transition in terms of electron spins, for example. You're going to encode the numbers into electron spins. And then, in classical theory, there's only one way of doing it. In quantum theory, you have many ways of doing it. For example, I can prepare an incoherent superposition, like a classical probability distribution with the same probability. But I also can do it as a superposition as well. That contains the same information. It's another physical support for the same amount of information. Does that make sense? Because the information is about the outcome of measuring. So both are equivalent. I have no idea what the result is, both in the incoherent superposition or the superposition itself. Makes sense? And then what I was writing here is as to write that is the same as writing this. Where this thing are zeros, and this is a Hadamard to the power small n. That's all. So it's a circuit representation of the preparation of this thing. That's all I meant.
But the thing that I don't understand, the last thing that you wrote, Hadamard acting on a bunch of zeros.
Yeah.
If I my inputs, like I change the name of a person there. What change
is
there?
Think this of this as convention. This is not something physical.
But this is not dependent on the classical input. This is the thing that bothers me.
Like, the classical input are all the binary numbers that you can build with that many bits.
But those bits are zero at the beginning, right?
Ah, no, I don't care. I just want the... No, I want this at the beginning. This is what I want at the beginning. The uniform superposition of all of them. And one way of obtaining it, if you imagine an experimentalist that tells you, prepare that. I don't know about preparing states. Just tell me, I can prepare ground states of something or some zero state on a computational basis. Tell me how I build this. Okay, sure, apply. Can you build Hadamards? Yes, I know how to build Hadamards. It's this particular optical instrument. Okay, just do Hadamards in all the channels when you have zero and you get that. There's a recipe to obtain it from some state that you declare zero in the computational base. Does that make sense? Okay, cool, yeah.
S, right, not X.
Oh my God. Thank you, thank you. Indeed. More questions? So, believe it or not, these questions are extremely, these are the questions that are always asked about Grover's algorithm. Because, of course, you need to see how this connects with a real search that you do every day. Yeah, go ahead.
So one thing I'm also trying to understand is, you know, you were saying, okay, well, let's have an auxiliary Hilbert space that we tensor, and that's the information we actually want. So the state I'm imagining now is like the state we have, but with an extra like IX, so it's or something. But then how would we, I mean, if maybe we should just, maybe I'll just ask this later so we don't.
Yeah, maybe let's see the algorithm and we can ask later, right? But the idea is that, yeah, you can attach quantum stuff to things that you want to find. That's the idea. Instead of attaching classical things, you attach quantum things. What quantum things? Well, whatever you control the best in your lab and you can attach to registers. Does that make sense? That's the idea.
I think we have some tensor product to this stuff that you drop them, right?
What's that?
We have some tensor product to these labels, which has the physical information, right?
That's right, but this is this. This is a tensor product of 0, 1, and 1.
the name of the array. But there should be a tensor product that has physical information. For example, I give you a bunch of boxes, just one of them has a spin up, other.
Correct. That's right. So these are states, different states that are measurable. There's elements of a basis of states that you can distinguish, orthonormal, states that you can distinguish when you measure. That's the idea. That's what plays.
Something physical inside. Like
correct.
But why you drop them? Why you don't write them?
Like, you don't need them. You're
because
labeling your list by. But once you find that label, you have that information.
That's right. So it doesn't matter. It's independent of how you implement it. It's just every different state that you can measure is a number. You assign a number. If you want, I can build a map from your favorite system that you can measure 8 different orthonormal states to labels. And I call them numbers, right? It's the same as writing 1, 2, 3, 4. Remind this angular momentum, for example. And you have angular something that has angular momentum that can go can have 8 levels, right? You just label the first one, second one, third one.
No, what I think is something is wrong. Can I comment, draw something?
Can I what, sorry?
Can I comment,
yeah.
Draw something very fast? Just
on as in like coming? Yeah, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Sorry.
But again, this is independent of what you actually use to realize.
But the thing that bothers me is we have a bunch of tensor products with a big factor, right?
I'm gonna move this. Well, no, those are your labels. The information is contained in whatever is tensor with that, right?
Yeah.
Ah, gotcha, yeah. Correct.
So when you you also should write this physical information inside, right?
Yeah, but I don't care. Yeah, but I don't care about that. You see what I mean?
Like, I kind of assume you just patch all this out.
To begin with, this is not a physical operation. This is a way to write the circuit, right? So this is just, you need to prepare this superposition. And this superposition contains the omegas, yes.
The thing is, we don't need to make this. This is the physical information. But you factor this out.
No, I don't. Okay. So what I'm saying is I can have, imagine, x1, x2 with the physical information. And still, I add with a Hadamard on this and still prepare that. If every single one is, if you entangled.
Hadamard on all these, right? Like, what happens in this one?
The same, because this, every superposition, what you have is the Hadamard on those states, right? It doesn't matter. That's the point.
Okay, yeah. If you write this,
I think that the information. It will not even be quantum.
Yeah, it could be classical as well.
You're just
this is finding a box, you know? That's what we are doing.
My understanding is inside this box, there's a bunch of this.
Yeah, well, or whatever.
Now.
You can put classical info as well.
But we want to find this down.
Correct. Okay, forget about the information is not quantum. What you have here
is simpler.
It's not simpler. If you have a poem. If you have a poem here, another poem here.
You're just trying to locate that box.
That's right.
Think about the
I think.
Sure, and we can discuss it. Let's finish it because we're going to have kind of maybe not enough time, but we'll see. But we can discuss it at the end. The idea here is to find a box based on a label, same as in a classical search. You have a phone book, right? You can tell me, it's not enough with the number. The number is associated to a person. I don't care. We just want to know the physical position of it to look at it. That's what you want to do. Anyway, so we prepare. Where's the erase? We prepare that state, which is the one containing the information that, well, I actually don't know where the one I'm looking for is. It's a homogeneous superposition of all the possible states for the labels. And then what we're going to do now. That didn't work. That doesn't work either. Okay. Right. What we do now is a step called amplitude amplification. All that we've done so far is flip the amplitude of the register we're looking for. That's what this oracle does, right? Flip the sign of the amplitude. So let's do amplitude amplification. This is very easy to understand geometrically. Okay, so let's do this. Consider the 2D subspace spanned by as so your original state and state W, right? Well, this is not, this is definitely a spanning set for a 2D subspace, obviously. But of course, the two states are not orthogonal. As we know, the inner product between them is 1 root n, right? 1 over root n. So let me build an orthonormal set. Orthonormalize this. And that gives me W, of course. I'm going to take W. And another state that I'm going to call S prime. Okay, and then what is S prime? Well, orthonormalization. So take S, remove the part that is overlapping, and renormalize the whole thing. All right. Okay. Now, of course, we can think of geometric. Maybe I should do the geometric stuff in a different board. Yes. What's up?
There has to be some inner product.
Yeah. So what do you mean by inner product?
S minus the component of...
Oh, my bad. Yeah. I'm the worst. Sorry about that. All right. Thank you. All right. Now, I'm going to do the geometric bit here. With all the, because if you have to do the drawings, oh, not clean one. Let's see. This one's clean. Because of my handwriting and my drawing ability, it's better to separate the board. So we begin with this. We begin. So what's the state? You can represent the state S, right, as some component, I'm going to call it cosine theta S prime, plus some component sine theta W, right? So I can draw the thing. Right, let's say this is the winner axis, and this is the S prime axis, right? So you're going to have here an angle theta, and this is your state S. Agreed? This is the two-dimensional subspace I'm talking about. All right. So after applying the oracle, so if you apply the oracle, right, after applying the oracle to S, so applying oracle to, what time is it? Applying the oracle to S. So if I draw the amplitude, so S has, let me put it here, S, if I write all the amplitudes here, it might not represent them as bars, is, this is the winner amplitude, right? But there is uniform, right? After applying the oracle, you do this, what you go to is to similar plot with the difference that when you get to W, the amplitude is negative. The amplitude is negative, right? Uniform. Right, so what I'm gonna do after doing that, the amplitude being negative, so first of all, let's draw that. If I apply the, if I invert the sign of the W component, what I'm doing is a reflection over the S prime axis, right? So, try to draw it properly. Properly, more or less. It's still theta, and this is U, W, and an S. Agree, everybody? Where is the same? It's the same angle, even though it doesn't look like it, right? My drawing skill. Make sense, everybody? All righty. So now, we're going to do the step of amplitude amplification. So what is the amplitude amplification? Apply. So you see, geometrically, you can tell what I'm going to do. So I want to apply a reflection over the S axis now. Take S as an axis and do a reflection of this over that. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
What you said as the strength
vector. All right. I want a unitary that takes me from this to state here. Let me call it U. I'm going to call this diffuser, well, S typically. US, UW, S, right? So this thing is three times, my drawing skills, you know?
Right.
What are you reflecting over?
Over S. I want to reflect over the S-axis, so that thing would be 2 theta, right?
Yeah.
So let me just do twice the angle. So that's going to be, say that this actually did pretty well. Sorry, it looked not that bad. This is 2 theta, this angle.
Got it.
Theta, which means that this angle is 3 theta now.
Yeah.
I want to do that. What is that? Well, that is easy. This operator is just a reflection with respect to S. So let's write the reflection operator in that two-dimensional space with respect to S. Apply a reflection about S. So this is US, which is twice the projector S minus the identity. That implements the reflection with respect to it. Make sense, everybody? So we can write, I mean, we have the geometric interpretation, which is nicer. But we can write, for example, just naively, what is it? So if you have, let me do three things. If I have UW, have S to begin with. I apply S, remember, is the homogeneous superposition. I apply UW to S. What do I get? Well, okay, so you get S, but you invert the W component, right? Read, everybody?
Yes.
They subtract one W component and subtract another one. So basically flips the W component. And of course, then you can have now, I can apply US to UWS. And that is, of course, 2S minus 1 applied to S minus 2 NW. What you get is S minus 4 root N. Right, S, W, this thing is of course 1 over root N, right, plus 2 root N, W, okay, and that thing gives you 1 minus 4 divided by N, S, plus 2 divided root N, W. So you can tell that it's kind of subtracting from the homogeneous probability distribution, but amplifying the W component a little bit. That makes sense? Now, geometrically, it's much easier, right? Because what we are doing is clearly, if theta is small enough, if I don't overshoot this thing, right, clearly, I'm getting closer to W. No? This is the winner state, and I'm moving my state that starts at S in these two steps, woo, closer to the winner state. Does that make sense? Right. So what I'm doing after this second step is doing this. Now my amplitudes are, if this is 1 over root n for my amplitudes, what I've done is I have subtracted a little bit for every single one of them so that I can get a little bit more for the winner state. Make sense? So there is a particular way of shaking your phone book so that you alter the probabilities that when you check at random, you're going to get the right one when you check at random. Does that make sense? All right. Now, of course, we can compute. By the way, this is all the steps. So let me just write the circuit. So if you start from 0 to the n, which is that when I write nothing, means that I initialize everything at 0 for a circuit. I have a preparation stage, which is the Hadamard to the small n. Okay. And then the algorithm is implemented by this non-local UW, and then the diffuser, right? 2S, S minus identity. And in the end, you apply this many times. We'll see how many. And in the end, you're going to measure in the computational base, right, to obtain a raised. Ah. How many times do I have to do this? Well, that's easy because I start with, so before I start, I get S, right? Let's see, one application, what one application does. At the beginning, I have S, which is the cosine, right? Yeah, cosine theta S prime plus sine theta W. After one application, I have S. And now I have one application, so is the cosine of 3 theta, right? S prime plus the sine of 3 theta W. I can do that again. I can apply the algorithm again. I can invert the sine of the W component and do the reflection of rest. It's like starting again, but with a different initials. Oh.
Of course, sorry. I did forget that. W, yes.
Now I can consider this my new initial state and repeat the whole thing. Invert the amplitude of W and do the amplitude amplification. If I do it n times, say that I do, well, I'm going to say m times. Or should I do capital N? Because capital N is the total. Kind of sad that I pick capital N for the total number. Is that, that's the usual.
We didn't use capital N anywhere else.
Yeah, I could. I'm going to use M, right, for now, but you understand. I should have called the list perhaps M.
Yeah.
M times, okay, if you do that, then you get that the state doing this operation and M times, we're going to get cosine of 2n plus 1 theta s prime plus the sine of 2n plus 1 theta w. Right? So, of course, if you do it too much, you overshoot. So you need to know how many times you should do it. Otherwise, you're going to end up going the other way.
That N is M, right?
Ah, yes. Sorry. I'm going to keep doing that, and I apologize in advance. All right. Make sense, everybody? And then we can ask, okay, how many times do I have to do it? Well, you want this theta to be pi over 2 for a perfect solution, right? By the way, if you have a finite small number, you may not get to pi over 2. You need to be lucky to actually land on pi over 2 here, right? But you can check, okay, what's the closest you can get to pi over 2? And if you have many, by the way, if your number of races is many, this angle is going to be very tiny. Remember this angle didn't I write it? Right, this angle, the cosine, so let me just write it here. The sine of theta, remember, sine of theta is 1 over square root of n, because that's the component in the winner direction. So this thing, if n is really big, the theta is going to be really small. So you can actually more accurately get closer to the winner. The more elements you have, the more accurate we will become at the end. That makes sense? All right. So let's compute how many times I have to do it. So I want our best results. Oof, time. You have another lecture after this one? You do, huh? Our best results, 2n plus 1, because I want to show you on the computer as well. 2n plus 1, and then talk about something crazy too. And it's theta, it's pi over 2, right? That's what I want in the ideal case. So what is an m? What is the value of m that gives me the optimal? How many times do I have to do it to get the optimal result? All right, so that means that m is, of course, pi over 4, the arc sine of 1 over root n, okay, minus 1 over 2. So that's actually it. This is it. But if n is really large, then you can Taylor expand the sine. So if n, m, I know this is n. Huh? So n is capital N if you 1 or 2 to the small n, the number of qubits, right? If your number of entries is really large, so n
much larger than 1, then m goes like pi square root of n divided by 4. It's, of course, order square root of n. Agreed? Go ahead.
Yes.
Yeah, that's linear. Arcsine equals the argument because it's a small argument. So this algorithm scales with the square root of n. In order to get the best possible theta, you have to repeat the process of the order of square root of n for a large enough set of registers, which has to be compared with n, which is the number of times you have to, in a classical book, to guarantee that you get the right answer by randomly checking, you have to go by a number of n. Actually, n over 2, right, on average. Make sense?
Yeah.
All right, so let's see it in action. Hopefully, we have the time. Seeing it in action, I know it's kind of dumb in a way, but also not, if you know what I mean. Start. Oh, no. Start. And then we'll discuss something wild. And the wild thing, or wild, like, I'll give you the warning that we leave science to talk about wild hypothesis of things, right? Which is cool in PSI, I think. All right, so this is the same thing we saw last day, right? Let me just define my basis, my operations. All right, very good. All right, rubber example. So, okay, let's do it with 3 qubits. So let's compute how many times we have to do it with 3 qubits. And you see that the optimal is going to happen when you do it twice, basically. Does that make sense?
Okay.
And also you see that it's not going to be exact for 3 qubits. So let's see how good it's going to be. All right, first of all, let's initialize the all zeros. That's the vector of all zeros, right? Now, let's compute the equal superposition. Nice. I applied the tensor product of the Hadamards, and I have the equal superposition. OK. Now, the winner. What is the winner? Let's say that we want to find the 1-1-0 entry. So I define the winner as the 1-1-0 entry. Make sense? And I define the oracle as, again, just flips that component. Cool. Let's do the product of the two. The product of the two meaning like, okay, let's act on S, on the original state. And of course, you see that all that we did is flipping the amplitude of the winner. Now, of course, we build now the diffuser, what is called the diffuser, which is the reflector over the S axis, which is not very illuminating to look at, but it's that. And then I define here the Grover algorithm, right? So this is apply the Grover algorithm. Steps is just apply. US, UN, US, UW, n times, and 2S. All right, so let's do first one step, or zero steps, right? Zero steps, this is the amplitudes or homogeneous amplitudes, right? Let's do one step. Ah, look at that. Probability of getting the winner went up quite a little. Then let's do I equals 2. All right, even better. So after I equals 2, we get the best that we can have, which is the probability of finding the right one is 11 times larger than finding any of the other ones. Make sense? This is the best we can do. Well, maybe not. You can keep rotating if you want and until you find a better, because eventually you may land the closest, not guaranteeing the first time that you would. But obviously, if you do it another time, that's going to overshoot, right? So let's just see it. Yeah, that's overshooting, right? In fact, it can get worse, because if you keep rotating, it's going to get worse, right? So with 4, probably, look at that. That's worse. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to do 2. Huh? So of course, now what you have to do is just randomly measure, and you will obtain the one you want. Now, of course, this is not perfect. But as you know, this as the number n, the number of registers, the number of qubits, right, goes up, this is going to get lower and lower, because theta is going to be lower and lower. Make sense? So what this is intended, of course, for is for a large list to find on a, which is when it's problematic for computers to find. Eh? That makes sense? And it scales like the square root of the original one. Computer scientists would tell you, that's a meh kind of improvement. But it's still an improvement that you can get with quantum theory. But there are some fundamental things I want to tell you about Grover. One of them is that one can prove that the algorithm is quantum optimal. But that, I mean, there's no better quantum algorithm that searches faster than that. And that is big. In computer science, that's big, because when you talk about equivalence classes of complexity, that matters. That tells you that, result. The class of problems that can be solved with a quantum computer is certainly not MP hard, not MP the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
And the reason is because if it were, we should find something, we can reduce the order of n to something that is log, and we can't. We're going to get into, that's a proof that you have to do complexity theory for, but that's the point. So it's not true that a quantum computer can always do exponential problems in polynomial time. Not true. That's a proof already. It cannot do polynomial problems in log time, because this is optimal, and that's the best you can do, right? So that's kind of interesting. It's not that quantum computer is, sometimes you find some problems for which you can find an algorithm of less scaling complexity. Now, another thing that is interesting, and this is an important point, but time and so on, so making it very fast, but hopefully that sinks, right? Quantum computers is not true. This is an NP-hard problem. This is an NP-complete problem. Well, it's not, if we had only a quantum computer, but not true. A quantum computer will not solve all those problems, okay? It may solve some in a better time. Yeah, go ahead.
So what's stopping me from, like, first, like, instead of this oracle, if I just make, like, the opposite where I just flip every sign except for W, and then I apply that to S, and then I interfere it with another copy of S, then I should be able to just apply it once and always get the right answer. So what's, what's the issue with that?
There's no issue with that, but the number of operations that you need to do for that, right? I mean, let's see.
Just the one.
You need copy, yeah.
I don't know, maybe
No, but you need copies, right? You need copies. There's different resources that you need for that. Here you're given just the superposition and a winner state and a winner label. And then you should be able to locally build the oracle, and you are able to use it to the only copy that you have, right? One list. For yours, you need more than one copy of the list. And that's a problem, you have only one, right? Because you cannot really clone it or anything.
Sure, but I could just have two sets of zero and apply it to...
Yeah, but that's cheating in the sense that it's no longer unstructured. So you need copies, you use an extra structure.
But it's not copies in the sense that I have two quantum computers and they each have a zero in my initial state. I apply Hadamards to the first one, I apply Hadamards to the second, so I have two...
What I mean is that you have twice the resources that you can do classically too. Classically, I can make a blank list that is equivalent to mine, and then I can use them to do better algorithms classically as well.
Sure.
That's not the one that competes against the searching from one phone book. That's what I mean.
But is that, like, classical dual algorithm going to be able to do it in one shot?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, I'll have to think about it. But what I mean is it's not legit to compare them.
I get that point.
All right, so here's one thing. And I'm kind of rushing to, sorry about that. I don't want to rush, but we will. We can start the Monday class by, you know, thinking about it, and we can have discussions about it. This is only one more topic I want to cover. So this is how, I'm plotting here the number of times that you need, which is, of course, just the square root, right, of the number. The number of times that you need to apply to get to the closest possible. Now, let me point out this. Well, I'm not going to run it because I already ran there. So you can ask, okay, what numbers give you exact number of steps that you would get with? We know that for large number of them, we get exact, very approximately, right? As it goes to infinity, we always get exact because theta is tiny. You're always going to get arbitrarily close to it as you increase n. However, what about a low number of registers and still being able to be exact or almost exact? So there's something interesting. For 4 is exact. For 4, you do it in one go. You have 4 registers, so 2 qubits. That's an example that you see always out there, because it's one shot and it's perfect. That supports Trace Grover in the best light. That's it in one shot with 4. And there's also the number 20, it's for 3, is really close to an integer as well. So, stupid wild thing to think about. Imagine that you are asked to do something optimally, right? And the thing that you're asked to do optimally, you can build whatever system you want. In mind that the thing that you want to do optimally is searching, you have to encode, you have to decide how many bits or qubits of information to use to encode my information for a process, right? And I want to be able that always in among 4 elements, which is 2 qubits, right? Among 4 elements, I want to be able to find one very fast. perhaps in one go. And also at the same time, with 20 elements, I want to do the same. So if at the same time I want to do 4 and 20, Grover algorithm is great. It's low numbers, but it's the optimal. It's the one that you would select for if you're looking for optimality, right? There's a wild, very wild thing. Again, don't take it as science. It's actually falsifiable, so you could do it. We know of something in nature that encodes information with 4 units, with 4 registers. And we also know a process related to that that encodes information with 20. You know what that is? What's that?
DNA.
DNA. So we have, of all the nucleic, all the hydrogen bases that you can use for DNA, you can use many. We can use, at least people have built artificial ones with more than 20. But it's only 4 that participate in life. Now, also amino acids. There are extremely, I don't remember how many, but there are many amino acids that are stable. Among them, life only uses 20 of them. So wild hypothesis, maybe the way they're finding the molecules among the unstructured search is using some sort of Grover algorithm implemented. That is falsifiable, because you can actually try to build spontaneous processes in life with 5 bases and 27 amino acids and see what happens. But this is something interesting, that actually the maxima happens where one of the most important search problems in life. Life is interesting from the physics point of view, because we only use a particular chirality of molecules, and we only use a particular number. And you would imagine if all of them were stable, right, when life started. So there are 2 things. Life may have started in 1 point on Earth, and that's fine. Then that would explain why everybody is the same, right? But imagine that life is something that happens with some probability that is non-zero, and you have enough time, and you have 2 places on Earth where it happens, or many, many places on Earth where it happens. You would expect that all the possible structures are possible. But it so happens that we have some chirality and some number of nucleic acids and amino acids that we use, and no more, and no less. There's no life we don't know of any life on Earth anyways. It is like that. Why? Then you can check out the physics, right? Okay, chirality. There are very few processes in physics that distinguish chirality, right? Fundamentally, it's only the weak interaction that does. Then you can actually try to do a correction to the potential of the molecules with right chirality and left chirality, and sure, the one that we have is the one that's favored by the weak interaction. But it's favored by a tiny bit. There's no chance that that could explain why we have one, right? So anyhow, this is kind of interesting to do fantasy about. That's it. Sorry about that. I'm done. You're in the next lecture, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah. Taking too much time. Anyway, sorry. I just compressed the Grover algorithm in 1 hour using classical means only, yeah? So that is a bit of a feat. Okay, there's only one more thing conceptually that is left in the course. It's talking about, well, you're going to see SOAR algorithm and how SOAR algorithm has the potential one of these decades to put out of business our main means of doing cryptography, which is RSA, based on the difficulty of factoring prime numbers versus the easiness of multiplying numbers. We have to talk about quantum cryptography, so ways in which you can use quantum theory to guarantee security in communication. And that's the last thing we're going to do conceptually. It can be told mostly in 1 day. So above all, we have 2 hours on Monday, no? Right, so it will be definitely told there. We're going to use the rest for discussion and the day that is left for discussion, given that the 2 tutorials are probably going to be short algorithm, right? So you can prepare questions and discussions for the next week. It's going to be the main component.